This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 5th, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Let's go ahead and take a look at what's been going on this past week in the areas involving federal taxes. We're going to start with the case of Dunnigan versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-190. This particular case deals with a taxpayer who had negotiated a reduction in debt on a credit line for his business. Now, Mr. Dunnigan had a lot of things go wrong this particular year. Mr. Dunnigan apparently was suffering from cancer. His marriage was apparently on the rocks. He had separated from his wife, but they hadn't finalized a divorce by the end of the year. And he had debts canceled in four separate places where he couldn't pay debts on his business debts. Now, three of those he reported on his tax return. But a fourth one, which involved a $50,000 credit line that he had with the bank to handle business debts, he negotiated that deal, and the lender told him that essentially he wasn't liable for the remainder, and even checked the box on the 1099-C to indicate that the taxpayer was not liable for repayment of the debt. Mr. Dunnigan also discussed with the IRS office in his area regarding the issue about cancellation of debt. And on this particular debt, the IRS had apparently told him that, well, he should just explain it on his return and he should qualify for a hardship relief. So he should be able to get out of this particular issue. So in his line, he had a couple of reasons why it's not taxable. The bank didn't mark the box that he was personally liable on the debt on the 1099-C, and the IRS indicated he should get hardship treatment. So he included the 1099-C with the tax return, but attached an explanation with the 1099-C, and that particular explanation had said, effectively, that please note, the bank had indicated to me I'm not liable for repayment of the canceled debt. I had explained to them I have serious cancer problem, that I'm 76 years old. Thus, they marked box 5 no. Local IRS office suggested I explain the situation at the time of filing and felt it would likely come under hardship rules for approval. So he filed his return this way. Well, of course, the IRS issued basically a notice to him because they got a 1099-C, and regardless of how that box is checked, there was a cancellation of debt shown on the 1099-C. So Mr. Dunnigan went back to court. Now, remember, he knew he had cancellation of debt for two of these, or for three debts, and he reported those particular debts were not small amounts either. They'd reported nearly $70,000 of income from those other obligations. But what he hadn't done was report this one. So he first started out and said, well, they told me I'm not liable on the debt, so there couldn't be cancellation of debt if I didn't owe it. And unfortunately, as the court pointed out, that's not really how this works. Even if that debt were truly non-recourse, and of course, given the facts of the case and the agreement he had with the lender, it's pretty clear the debt was recourse. The lender just decided not to enforce collection. That's pretty much the standard definition of cancellation of debt. But they said even if it had been a non-recourse debt, if the lender agrees to take cash less than the debt amount and doesn't repossess the security, what you're going to find is you still have cancellation of debt. So for instance, if you had a non-recourse debt on your home and that debt and the, you know, you owed $50,000 on it, but the bank agreed to let you pay it off for $40,000, that's still cancellation of debt income, even though the debt may have been non-recourse if you had that particular setup or you're in a state that has those debts as non-recourse. But that doesn't matter. It's still COD. Well, secondly, he said, well, the IRS and the bank both said that there was a hardship exclusion I could get out. Well, turns out, obviously, there is none. As the court points out, Section 108 has various exclusions where we can keep cancellation of debt income out of income. None of them discuss hardship. The closest we've got would be either the bankruptcy or the insolvency exceptions, and he hadn't shown he met either one of those, and merely being sick and being in the middle of a divorce definitely imposes hardships, but neither one of those is going to qualify you for not having to pick up cancellation of debt income. Finally, well, yeah, but the IRS had told him that he should get a hardship exemption, and can't he rely on that? And unfortunately, as the tax court pointed out, no. Advice given to you by the IRS over the phone may allow you to escape penalties, and the IRS was not asserting Mr. Dunnigan owed a penalty, but it doesn't allow you to get out of the basic tax. It's still taxable, and Mr. Dunnigan had to pay tax on that cancellation of debt income. So that basically caused him a problem. He was still going to end up with taxes. Now let's go on to the other side of a transaction where we have a debt that's not going to be repaid for the full balance. This is the case of Cooper versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-191. In this particular case, Mr. Cooper had loaned money to various people, including a company, Wolper Construction, Inc., that was a real estate developer. This is the mid-2000s, so you can pretty much guess how this is going to turn out. It won't be well for Mr. Cooper, who loaned the money to the developer. In fact, at the end of the day, he apparently loaned him well in excess of $1 million. Well, in this particular case, he missed a repayment date the company did in 2007. But Mr. Cooper indicated that he wasn't really concerned about that year. In 2008, the company filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection claim. But when it listed its statements of assets and liabilities, it showed that it had, in essence, tens of millions of dollars of equity. In this case, we ended up with a significant equity at this point. So basically, even though they showed that they, you know, they couldn't have cash flow to pay the current debts, there still was plenty of equity. So that continued on. In 2009, a bank basically began questioning whether or not this thing really had all this money, and it was forced into Chapter 7. And one of the issues the bank had questioned was they had put a high value on a mechanic's lien. The value on the mechanic's lien had, in fact, been put at over $36,500,000. Well, in 2010, when that lien was actually sold, the bankruptcy court gave approval to sell it, and they sold the lien, it sold for a whopping $116,000. Bank was right. It wasn't really worth what it was on the statements at. And so at that point in 2010, now it became clear that this company was woefully, shall we say, upside down. Insolvent because the bank also had asserted debts that weren't on the list. So we had lots of problems here, and now suddenly it's like, well, we're not going to get repaid. The taxpayer filed an amended return for 2008 claiming the bad debt deduction. And then when the IRS challenged him, he, as a backup position, said, well, if it wasn't bad in 8, it was bad in 9. And secondly, I'm in the business of lending, so I can write it off for partial worthlessness. Well, the tax court first looked at the issue of, well, was this a business loan? And they determined he was not in the business of loaning money. He only made 12 loans over a 6-year period, which the court found was not really frequent enough. He lent money only to friends and acquaintances. That's not what you'd usually do if you're in the business of lending money. He failed to conduct his business in accordance with normal formalities. He actually got no real security for loans, didn't investigate credit histories, skipped a whole lot of steps that would normally be part of due diligence of doing this. He did not publicly hold himself out as lending money, so he didn't tell anybody. He had to basically find out, you know, or he found out you had financial issues if you were one of his buds, and then he would offer to loan you money. And essentially, and he didn't keep really adequate records on this lending activity either. So he had a lot of problems and a lot of issues. Thus, if there was a bad debt in either 2008 or 2009, the court found it would have to be a non-business bad debt. Business bad debts can be partially written off and they count as ordinary losses. Non-business bad debts cannot be partially written off. They have to be wholly worthless in the year in question and they are short-term capital losses. So now we're going to take a look at whether we would have a short-term capital loss in one of the 2 years. Not exactly something you'd like to have if you have your choice. Ordinary losses are a whole lot better, especially on a capital gains, and we're looking at only $3,000 of deduction. But it turns out that wasn't terribly relevant anyway because the court found he could not show it was worthless at the end of either 2008 or 2009. What really happened was one big problem was he continued to report the debt as an asset on a loan application to personal financial statement that was prepared in 2009. So the court said, well, clearly by the end of 8, it wasn't worthless because during 2009, here's two different times you claimed this loan had a value of over $1 million. And when he prepared his 2008 income tax return in October of 2009, on the original return, he didn't claim it as worthless. And you would think had he known it was worthless by October, he would certainly have claimed it on the 2008 return. In fact, the court found there's no evidence he really ever knew it was worthless until the mechanic's lien was sold in 2010. At best, that's the date when it might have been worthless, but the court doesn't need to worry about that because that wasn't the year before it. And secondly, so the court found that at the end of 2008 and 2009, he had not proven that the debt was worthless. And because of that, no loss deduction would be allowed for either year. So he ended up with no deduction for a bad debt on either the 2008 or 2009 return, and 2010 and later years remain to be discovered. Next up is a case of Precision Dose versus the United States. And this is a case that's actually, it's 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5272. The opinion was issued on the 24th of September. This particular case, the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois Western Division looked at whether a company could qualify for a 199 production deduction. And this is a company that created single doses of medicine. It would receive medicine, liquid medicine, sometimes pills, etc., and it would basically put them into single dose containers and then sell those off. Now, the IRS had argued that this was simply packaging, repackaging, labeling, and minor assembly. Those are activities that are excluded from the definition of what will qualify under 199 under Regulation 1.199-3E2. Now, the problem is the court in this case agreed with the finding of the California District Court from 2013 in the case of United States versus Dean. That found in that case that this was a company that repackaged gift baskets, basically made gift baskets. And so they'd paste all these items in a gift basket and ship that off. The court found that that was not merely repackaging, but was manufacturing. The Illinois court agreed with that ruling and decided that, hey, you know, this should count in this case. This is not merely repackaging, they're adding value. Because they are adding value by making them into single dose containers, that's manufacturing. Now, one negative problem that we've got with this is the IRS has issued, and they issued in August of this year, proposed regulations that would add an example to the existing regulations under Section 199 to clarify specifically that the Dean decision should be reversed. That would be considered an example of merely repackaging. So the good news is you have a client like this or like Dean. We have two district court cases in very widely dispersed districts that tell us that this qualifies for 199. The bad news is the service is going to likely change the regs here shortly to get rid of that. That then opens up the whole question about whether that's a reasonable interpretation of the regulation, because now we're back to having to make a decision under the Mayo case, the Mayo Foundation case from the Supreme Court about the reasonableness of the decision. And frankly, it's likely, given how broad Justice Roberts' allowance was for the IRS interpretations to be respected, that likely that will stand up. So this, you know, this regulation may shut this down. But nevertheless, if you have a client who has this, you may want to look at, should we consider amending returns? Now we have another case where the appellate court came in and this time sustained the tax court. This is City Line Candy and Tobacco Court versus Commissioner. This case was really decided in 2013, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in 116 AFR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5293, on the 30th of September, sustained the tax court's position. This particular company bought tax stamps. They sold cigarettes. They're a wholesaler of cigarettes. So they would buy tax stamps from the state of New York. Those tax stamps had to be affixed to the cigarette packages they were selling, and then they had to be included in the price when the cigarettes were sold. Now, this taxpayer was very near the $10 million average revenue for three-year limitation, and they decided they qualified for it because what they did was subtracted the revenue from the stamp tax revenue from their gross sales when they sold the product. Based on that, their average gross revenue for the prior 3 years was under $10 million. However, the Second Circuit agreed with the tax court that, in fact, they couldn't reduce it by that. They came and looked at a couple of key issues here. They decided that it was inherently part of the price. They also pointed out that the company actually got paid a commission and made money off of this, you know, from the retailers off providing the stamps. So the court found that was inherently a part of the overall revenue for the resale, and because of that, it counted toward the $10 million. It also found that they couldn't exclude those expenses. They said, well, okay, then they're selling expenses. They said, no, they don't qualify for that. They have to be capitalized as a 263 Cap A general expense and dealt with under the standard 263 Cap A rules, or capitalized as part of the actual cigarettes under a direct cost idea. Either way, they can't just write them off when they pay for them. The Second Circuit agreed with the tax court, sustaining their decision and finding that you cannot exclude these in computing the $10 million. Again, this is going to be key mainly if your client's right on the edge, but obviously, as CityLine Candy tells us, some clients are right on the edge. Next is a case of Okonkwo, and I know I'm having trouble with that person's name, and I will apologize to them if they happen to hear this, versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-181. This came down back on September 14th. This is an issue regarding a rental property the taxpayer had, and when they took it in for the taxes to be done for the year, their CPA noticed that the rental income was much lower than it had been in the past and asked them about it. Well, they informed the CPA that they were leasing it to their daughter at a much lower rent, and they were doing so because they didn't have a tenant, and their insurance policy required that their home be occupied for the insurance to be valid. So they needed somebody there, so they got their daughter in there, and they gave her a break so she'd move in. So the daughter rented from them at a below-market rent. Now, this creates a problem. Under Section 280 Cap A of the Code, generally, you're not allowed deduction for any property used as a residence, as a rental. And under the vacation home rules at 280AD1, it'll be considered to be used for personal purposes if used more than 14 days or 10% of the days when it's rented to somebody else at fair value. The daughter lived in this home the entire year. And since it was rented to the daughter under Section 280AD2 that provides that renting it at below market levels is considered to be personal use, now we got a problem that this is considered personal use. But they said, but wait a minute, we should get it because we have her in there for a business reason. We're protecting the insurance policy that otherwise wouldn't count. Tax court said doesn't matter in this case. Now, the one piece of good news for them was they escaped a penalty for claiming the deduction. Because they had fully informed their accountant, their CPA, who was experienced in real estate, about the facts of their situation, and he had advised them that he believed they could take the deduction, they will not be penalized in this case. Now, the one downside of this is we don't know what the service is going to think about the CPA and whether they might want to impose some sanctions there on the preparer level. Keep your eyes open because the service has indicated that when taxpayers get off on something like this, the service may very well consider coming after the preparer. Some neat information came out this week that you may need to be aware of if you have any payroll tax exams that are getting started. The IRS issued a memorandum revising the procedure for payroll tax examinations. This is Small Business Self-Employed Memorandum SBSE 04-0915-0058. What this memo does is tell agents what they need to do on examinations. And it has changes in various cases about procedural and scope changes. What it tells the agents to do first is check for compliance. An agent on every payroll tax exam, even a limited scope one, is supposed to check to make sure that all required information returns, Form 1099 and the like, have been filed by the taxpayer for the year in question, that they properly withheld FICA from all reportable payments, and that they filed all other tax returns, including non-payroll returns for the year in question. The agent is to confirm all of those when they open up a payroll tax exam. In the area of the scope of the examination, the ruling also gives us some issues there about dealing with that. The agent is told to determine if it's a limited scope exam or if it's meant to be a broad scope one. If it's limited scope, the agent still has to interview the taxpayer and tour the business. They have to complete the filing and compliance checks we just talked about. They have to fully develop the issues that were identified for limited scope. They had to prepare work papers, and if any of those steps reveal a material noncompliance issue, the agent will use his or her discretion with regards to whether to recommend to his or her manager that the examination should be expanded beyond the limited scope. And for other examinations, the agents will use the information obtained during the pre-audit, the interview of the taxpayer, and review of books and records to determine the scope of an examination and as well whether it should be expanded back into other areas. Under controlling the employment returns, they do state that it always should be an entire year under exam, that if the issue is one that could basically affect, it could be recurring, they should always open up the prior and following year, that they should generally not open up a current year's return except under unusual circumstances, a current year tax filing, and they shouldn't open up any year until after January 31st. That's the due date of the final 941. These new requirements replace what's in the Internal Revenue Manual, so what's in the IRM right now is outdated. The IRM will be updated within the next year, but the agents have been told to start using these procedures immediately. Next up, we're going to take a look at the case of American Milling Limited Partnership versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-192, issued on September 28th. In this case, the IRS issued a notice, in this case, an FPAA notice, to a lower-tier partnership in a son-of-boss transaction. In this case, the entity, the son-of-boss structure, involved two single-member LLCs and a partnership that the taxpayer conducted his business mainly through, and then there was a new LLC created. The two single-member LLCs, wholly owned by this one person, basically both entered into short sales of treasury notes, or treasury securities, I should say, and then basically they got $30 million of proceeds, contributed that for their interest, and they contributed the responsibility to close out the short sale. Now, under the son of boss transaction, the position taken is that responsibility to close out the short sale is not a liability. Therefore, that's $30 million a basis. And the other entity threw in a bunch of tugboats that they wanted to bump the basis up on. After the sale was closed, he transferred his interest in those single member LLCs to the partnership that had contributed the tugboats, making it now making the main partnership, the one underlying, all owned by one entity, so that liquidated that. And under the general rules, the basis in the assets that are distributed to them, and the only assets left were the tugboats, would be their basis in the partnership interest, which would include that $30 million of basis that the single member LLCs had. Well, the IRS attacked this, and at the district court level, attacking the lower level partnership, the IRS won there, and the court there found, in fact, for the IRS on two of their three issues in favor of them. They found essentially that the short sale obligations should have been treated as liabilities for this purpose, and the short sale transactions followed by a contribution to the partnership was a transaction that lacked economic substance. Now, the IRS didn't directly assess tax against the individual taxpayer at this point, and the owning partnership filed suit because it was the tax matters partner for the tax shelter partnership and challenged it. They lost, as noted. Now the IRS comes back a few years later and issues a notice against the higher level partnership, claiming that it had claimed excess depreciation on the property and attacking various other issues. Now, it issued another FPAA, this time to the higher tier. The taxpayer argued that, the IRS is barred under Section 6223F. They can't issue two FPAAs on the same issue. They have to issue just one. Well, the tax court said, no, this isn't a second one. They referenced back to a case they decided, Wise Guys Holdings versus Commissioner in 2013. They said the difference there when in Wise Guys, it actually was two issued to the same partnership. In this case, it wasn't the same partnership. The fact that they talked about it dealing with the same topics in Wise Guys wasn't controlling. That's not the issue. In this case, it deals with similar items. Secondly, they said that essentially, it shouldn't count here. It shouldn't need an FPAA because these are merely mechanical computations. There's nothing new here. The IRS had one shot. They should have done everything back when they did the first one. In this case, the court also disagreed. It said, no, things are different this time. There could be many reasons why your basis in the tugboats could be different. Could be that you did some improvements on them. There are various other things, so this is not merely mechanical. Therefore, this partnership exam stands on its own. It's not a duplication of the last one and not a mere mechanical computation. Therefore, the court found that it could go forward and actually hear the merits of this case, and it seems most likely that the taxpayer is going to end up losing if we have to go on the merits. So the bottom line is it's not good news for the taxpayers, because this had entirely different issues. So even if the items were related, it didn't matter. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 5th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments, as always, is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. Be sure to join us next week for more developments in the area of federal taxes and visit us online at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com.